The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. The holidays are quickly approaching, and for the procrastinators among us, with quick shipping and millions of sellers, the online retailer Amazon.com offers a ray of hope. But what if the gift you've purchased isn't what it claims to be? What if it's a counterfeit? For years, Amazon has been fertile territory for counterfeiters, and now it's fighting back. Here with more is Spencer Soper, a reporter with Bloomberg News who covers Amazon. Virginia spoke with him about his article, Amazon Gets Real About Fakes.
And Spencer, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
So any idea of how many counterfeiters are actively selling on Amazon?
No, I mean, the best way to quantify it, Amazon has said a small number of bad actors. That's all they've said in a lawsuit they've filed. But we're talking about more than 2 million sellers, so even a small fraction of that can be a sizable number.
Who are the counterfeiters? I mean, is this an organized, well-oiled machine?
They can be, and they can be comparable to drug rings, often overseas. They're very good at covering their tracks. So, yes, it can be a ring of people operating to move the product, infiltrate sites, get as many sales as they can before they're discovered and knocked off, only to pop up again. And a big thing with e-commerce that allows it to flourish there as opposed to like a store or even a, you know, maybe a back alley sale or something is that consumers are buying things based on images, you know, photos, product descriptions, not actually looking and seeing and touching the merchandise. So it gives them a better opportunity than it would on a store shelf.
So what kinds of products tend to be counterfeited?
It can be anything. A couple that we highlighted, and one in particular that Amazon is involved in a lawsuit with is this TRX training system. It's like these suspension straps that you can use for home workouts, using your body weight to do pull-up and pushing exercises, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that's a good example because the actual product is fairly high quality. They invest a lot in the materials to make sure that you have a good experience and that these things are sturdy and can handle your weight. And it's also a product where it's kind of a one-size-fits-all, so it's not like counterfeiting clothing where you have multiple sizes and things. Someone can do a run of this to counterfeit it, do it with cheaper materials, make something that looks kind of like it but is nowhere near the quality, and then sell it on Amazon, on other marketplaces at a lower price than the real product. And that's where the opportunity is. And a lot of times the consumers don't even realize.
Yeah, and the other thing about this guy that you profiled who runs TRX Training, he's a small company working by himself. He's an innovator. You know, he's come up with something interesting. And other inventors also, they don't have big, let's say, intellectual property muscle behind him. Kind of easy to rip off, it looks like.
Yeah, well, and it's easy to rip anybody off. So even the big players that have those intellectual property rights, you know, are prey to this. So all major brands have counterfeiting issues, and just that they have, you know, attorneys behind them and those sort of things is no protection. Bottom line is if people want the product, counterfeiters are going to figure out a way to copy it.
So you describe it as kind of a Wild West and a whack-a-mole, you know, that they knock one offline and another one pops up. Does Amazon hold any legal responsibility to a seller whose goods have been knocked off?
Yeah, that's a great question, and that's really at the heart of this. So the only real legal responsibility for Amazon or any other online marketplace selling goods is that they have to provide a mechanism for the intellectual property rights holders, you know, the people who make the authentic product, to report counterfeits, and then they have to respond in a timely manner. And so that's where this opportunity presents itself. So the example we gave of the TRX maker, this exercise equipment maker, it's on him to police Amazon's site, to look for counterfeits, to report those counterfeits, and to wait for Amazon to respond. Now, this process can take days, weeks, and all of that time, those products are lingering. And let's just explain this process a little more thoroughly. If you are an authentic brand holder and you see something on Amazon's site that you suspect is a fake and you're you're very much convinced it's a fake, that's not sufficient. You have to actually order the product, so you have to make it what's called a test buy. Then when you get the product, you have to take photos of that product, take photos of your authentic product, send that into Amazon and explain somehow, you know, help someone on the Amazon side differentiate what they're looking at so that they can make a determination that, yes, this is not the product that's being listed. So the time it takes for that process to play out presents a tremendous opportunity for these sellers to operate and snag as many sales as they can. And when they're knocked down, it's an e-commerce marketplace, so there's no inventory to seize. So they can just easily go sell the stuff under a new pseudonym on another site or the same site another day.
So now the company Amazon is cracking down. How are they proposing to get tougher on these fake good sellers?
Well, a big emphasis here is that, you know, we just talked about how this process as it stands is reactive as opposed to proactive. The things can get on there and then someone has to report them and there's a reaction to take them down. The emphasis now is on being more proactive and working with brands, big brands, to register in advance and tell Amazon, these are the people who are authorized to sell our products, and requiring sellers of those products to provide some sort of authentication that they can sell these products, to make it less of a Wild West atmosphere and to make it a less reactive atmosphere, kind of have a gateway to say, yes, I am allowed to sell these goods. I have permission. Here's the permission from the manufacturer or the brand holder, and to create more of a barrier for the counterfeiters from getting on the site.
How is this hurting Amazon as a marketplace?
Well, you talked about the legal obligation, and that's where they're okay. You know, you don't have to do much more beyond what they're already doing from a legal standpoint. But from a brand standpoint, you know, how many customers are going to buy phony products on your site? How long can you let this thing linger before it starts affecting your brand? Amazon is very trusted and well-regarded among its customers. People trust the idea that they can purchase something on Amazon and that it will get to them in a timely fashion and be the product that they've ordered. So if this counterfeit problem were allowed to continue to swell, that would be a significant issue for them if it eroded the trust in their company, which is so such a key piece of their success.
And not just from buyers, but also from brands, I would imagine.
Also from brands, yeah. So that's that was a sticking point. The counterfeit problem on Amazon was a sticking point for them to attract merchants to sell merchandise that their customers want. And the best, most prominent examples we were told about were Major League Baseball and the National Football League, both you know, in discussions with Amazon about selling, you know, branded merchandise on the marketplace, but having reservations about the counterfeits that flourish there, and that being a major sticking point, and them hoping that some of these new initiatives will remedy that problem and attract more sellers to the marketplace.
Spencer, how about consumers here? I mean, would they know the difference if something were a fake, or do they care? I mean, people do buy fake designer bags on the streets of the city or in Chinatown because they're cheap. We want cheap items.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to generalize, right? Some people probably don't care. Hey, if I get a convincing fake of a Gucci bag for less, and everyone thinks I have a Gucci bag, who cares? You know, some people have that mindset. I think where it gets more hazardous is where and more dangerous for brands is when you're talking about inferior quality, and that's where the exercise equipment maker was very concerned, because, you know, he's worried that someone buys what they think is a TRX training system, they hook themselves up to it, they're there suspending their body weight to do an exercise maneuver, and one of these inferior clips on it breaks, you know, snaps, and all of a sudden they crash down and maybe break their hip or dislocate a shoulder. And that's where there's a bigger threat for a consumer, is getting an inferior quality product and then having no recourse, because whoever you purchased it from is gone.
Virginia Prescott there, speaking with Spencer Soper, a reporter with Bloomberg News, about his article, Amazon Gets Real About Fakes. You'll find a link to it on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. In the early days of cinema, soundtracks were played live. A single pianist or an orchestra accompanied the film, sometimes written, sometimes improvised. They played music and sound effects. Recorded sound predates motion pictures, but combining the two took some time. In 1927, the jazz singer paved the way for talkies, and within a decade, silent movies and the musicians that accompanied them began to fade away. The group known as the Alloy Orchestra revives that old tradition of live scoring silent films by combining found percussion and state-of-the-art electronics. With just three players, they can create just about any sound you could imagine. And you can hear the Alloy Orchestra live scoring Buster Keaton's The General at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth this Saturday, December 17th. The three-man ensemble features Terry Donahue, Roger C. Miller, and Ken Winokur, who joined Virginia from a studio in Boston.
So tell us a little bit about the movie you'll be performing along with at the 3S, Buster Keaton's The General.
Well, The General is, in my opinion, one of the greatest films ever made. It's an amazing combination of a comedy. It's a Buster Keaton film, after all. But it's an epic about the Civil War. It's got a moving love story in it. And it's so unusual to be able to bring that kind of a serious subject together with a comedic movie and have it come out as, you know, a really powerful experience.
How do you come up with a score for these classic films? Are there any references left behind?
There are often references, but we essentially ignore them if they exist. We score our own music. We write our own compositions. And we do it as a contemporary film scorer would. We get the film, put it on the computer, and we go through it scene by scene. The three of us essentially improvise the original ideas. Any one of us is liable to throw out the first idea, and the other two of us come up with some accompanying part. And we just kind of go through the film scene by scene very quickly, getting ideas together until we get to the end. And then we start over again. We go through, we listen to what we've done. And if we like it, we'll start to make it not into these little simple ideas, but into full-blown music. We'll write extra parts, and we'll put in B sections and transitions, and at the very end, we'll do the sound effects.
But these are classic films, you know, made almost 100 years ago now in some cases, with old classic film tricks and sort of scenes and tropes. How do you sort of approach that with fresh eyes, you know, so the mustache-twirling villain doesn't get mustache-twirling villain music, or does he?
No, we really try to avoid the cliches of the silent music accompaniment. We don't write music within the time period of the silent era, which is to say, we'll write modern music. In the case of The General, it's not modern in so much as it's, you know, aggressive, brutalist, you know, atonal modern music. But it isn't necessarily conforming to either the time that the movie came out, which was, I believe, 1920. Good question. Six.
Seven, I think.
1926.
No, you had it. 1926 for The General.
And but more likely in The General, we're doing music that makes a little more sense for the Civil War era because it is a very much a time period piece. But anyway, we leave the door open for any type of music that we feel elucidates the character or accentuates the kind of emotional content that the director has already put into the film.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that at work. This is the Alloy Orchestra performing alongside Buster Keaton's The General. You started by making an original score for the movie Metropolis. This is Fritz Lang's 1927 classic for many. This was back in 1991. How many have you done since then?
We've done something like 30 features and probably 50 shorts. We do at least one a year. We've been doing this for 25 years now. And so we have a large repertoire.
How do you choose the films?
Well, it's a complicated process, actually. I try to watch everything. I look for the films that really move me. But then there's a practical side that has to be addressed. You know, where does this film come from? What's the best restoration? Is it going to be available for a long period of time? Does it come from a friendly source, an archive or a collector or a studio? Or is it someone who's notorious for not allowing people access to their materials? So when I've satisfied all those things, and usually working with a film festival, we'll finally decide on a piece.
Well, let's get a little sense of that. This is the Alloy Orchestra's recording for Metropolis. Whitaker is with me. He is one of three members of the Alloy Orchestra, and we're listening to a score created by that band for the film Metropolis. On Saturday, they'll be live scoring the Buster Keaton film The General at 3S Art Space in Portsmouth. So this is really, there's a mix of sort of sound effects, live Foley, as they call it, and a musical score. Is that how accompaniment was done back in the 1920s?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Accompaniment, I mean, there were so many silent film screenings, there were so many movies and so many musicians that every style you can imagine was experimented with at that point. A lot of especially the larger orchestras would have a percussionist who would do the sound effects live. But there was also this stream of thought that, you know, you shouldn't do the sound effects because they tend to distract from, watching the movie, the plot or the characters. So we take a middle road. We'll do sound effects when we feel that that really helps kind of clarify what's going on screen, but we'll try not to just do sound effects all the time gratuitously so that they're too distracting, except in the case of things like cartoons and quick comedies. You really can't, you know, kick somebody in the butt and not honk a horn.
So you use traditional musical instruments and equipment as well as found objects to create this sound, right?
This is your
rack of junk. Is that what it's called?
That's what we call it, yes.
What's on it?
Oh, plumbing pipes, horseshoes, a piece of galvanized metal bent in half, truck spring, and then there's lots of gongs and cymbals. And then down below that, there's drums, pots and pans, a zither that's never been tuned, and then fairly conventional, more or less orchestral percussion, snare drums, bass drums, tom-toms. So anything that makes noise, we'll bang on it, strum it, or caress it in some way to get a sound out of it.
You must look like the Beverly Hillbillies when you're transporting it.
Yeah, well, we're always joking when we're going through customs, and they're looking, of course, for weapons, and they X-ray our thing, and it's just filled with these strange metal objects. What do they think we're doing with this?
How much does it keep growing? I mean, how much has it grown over the years?
No, it's unfortunately shrinking as the airlines have raised their rates for baggage, and we do a lot of our shows by flying. We've had to cut back on the amount of junk. So it's unfortunately on the decline rather than the incline. We have it all in the studio. We have rooms and rooms of it that we can access anytime we need something. But we try not to add very much more to carry around.
So you're going to play something for us. What are you going to play?
I'm going to play some clips from Man with a Movie Camera, a Soviet documentary by director Dziga Vertov. And Dziga Vertov, before he became a film director, was a music student at the Moscow Conservatory, and he studied what they were calling constructivist noise music. And constructivist noise music is basically what we do, using whatever things make sounds or recorded sounds and putting them together in unusual and somewhat unpredictable fashion to make music. So in the movie itself, there's what they call the Bottle and Spoon Orchestra. You actually see the percussionist on the screen, and he's got a series of bottles, a dozen or so spoons, a washboard, a metal plate, And he's playing along with music as if that was a drum set.
There we have it, music from The Rack of Junk, created by the Alloy Orchestra for the film The Man with the Movie Camera. Ken, is there a weirdest object or a favorite object that makes an unexpected sound on your rack of junk?
Well, the audience favorite is a bedpan. We've been using the bedpan off and on for 30-plus years. It's got a kind of a harsh metallic quality. But we probably put it up there more for visual effect than actual sound. And in fact, as the real estate gets more and more precious on our rack, it's seeing the light of day less frequently.
So there are so many silent films have been lost to the ravages of time. You know, celluloid decomposes or erodes. I saw somewhere that the Library of Congress estimates about 70% of American silent films have been completely lost. So is what you're doing, is this a public service in some way, as well as an artistic endeavor, you know, a way to preserve or inspire people to want to preserve silent films?
Absolutely. I mean, I try not to be sanctimonious about it. If you don't want to watch a silent film, that's perfectly okay. But when we started in this business, the silent films were very hard to access. It was the days of VHS. They just started to come out on VHS, but it was only the very biggest titles. And through our work, the work of other musicians and some heroic restorationists at the archives, more films have been restored and more shows are being, you know, promoted so that people can come and see them in their glory, because you can watch it on your phone or your computer screen. But when you see it live in the theater with that big, beautiful projection and a live musical accompaniment, it can be a very powerful experience that you really miss when you see it in a canned fashion.
Ken Winokur is director of the Alloy Orchestra. You can see the orchestra perform live with Buster Keaton's classic silent film, The General, at 3S Art Space this Saturday, December 17th. More information on the performance and the orchestra is at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. And it's time for the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. This week's guest is Irish author Emma Donoghue, who is best known for Room, her novel written in the voice of a young boy confined with his mother to a single room. It was nominated for a Man Booker Prize and made into an Oscar-winning film, which she wrote the screenplay for. Her most recent novel is The Wonder. It's about a fasting girl in 1850s Ireland. Virginia spoke with her from our studios and asked her which is harder to write, the first sentence or the last.
Neither. It's one of those sentences in the middle. I find beginnings and endings both great and fun, but often there's a little bit of a boggy patch somewhere in the middle of a project where you can't skip it, but it's not the most exciting.
How do you know when you're done?
It never really feels done. It's just that by the time you've gone through the copy editor's queries and then the proofreader's queries and then perhaps the second or third pass proofreader, you're simply so sick of it at that point that even though you know you could make it better if you waited, you couldn't care less at that point. You just post it away.
How do you know then when it's time to pass it off to that editor?
I don't know. I always see it as a series of drafts and responses. It's like waves going back and forward on a beach. So it's rarely about being finished. It's just a feeling that I've got it as far as I can and that I need the editor's input.
I'm curious about that going back to something, because because your novel, Room, was adapted into an Oscar-winning film. Frog Music is being made into a film, and you wrote the screenplay for both. So what was that like, revisiting and adapting your own work for film?
It's great fun because the different medium has different tricks that it can do, and it has different limitations as well. In a film, it's much harder to show what people are thinking, but it's much faster and easier to show visual information. Plots tend to move more quickly in a film, but you can't cover as much. So almost everything about them is different because of the medium, and that's an enormously pleasurable challenge to tell a story all over again, trying to play to the strengths of the new medium.
Has it changed the way you write at all? You know, when you're writing a novel, do you think a little more visually?
You know, it's funny. People only ask this about film. Everybody assumes that film is such a thrilling thing to reach that you'll then write everything filmically. No, I've always worked in different genres. And, you know, I like my plays to be plays and my films to be films and my books to be books.
You mean you can help yourself from imagining which actor or actress is going to be playing somebody?
I don't do any of that fantasizing until the book is finished. I like the books to come first for me because you get to go very in-depth on what the characters are thinking. I'm not trying to produce a sort of halfway book and film. I prefer to really, you know, explore the strengths of a novel and then say to yourself afterwards, could this possibly work on film as well?
How much plotting or planning are you doing before you even write? Or does the original idea or characters or plot change more through the process?
I'm a huge plotter and planner because I don't think plot comes naturally to me, so I've had to painfully acquire these skills. I need to plot out what's going to happen in every chapter, in every scene even, and from whose point of view it'll be seen and exactly what new revelations the reader will get at each point. I find without explicitly planning that stuff, my books would be baggy messes. But of course, you allow yourself to deviate. In particular, when two of my characters start talking to each other, there's often a spark between them of either flirting or hostility or something going on subtextually. I accept that kind of, last minute suggestion from my characters as I'm going along. I don't, you know, tap my plans and say, we must stick to this. Basically, the books end up the way I plan them, and I would consider all that planning part of the writing.
And there have been some very strong female characters in your books, you know, facing unusual stressors, we'll say it like that.
Stranger than I've ever had to deal with.
Then where do you get that from? Are there real people behind your characters watching people go through distress?
Sometimes I'm inspired by real people, yes. Like my last novel, Frog Music, was about a very real young woman who got shot dead through a window in 1876. I draw on qualities in my friends or things I've seen people live through. Even my historical fiction would often contain things I've seen nowadays. And my contemporary fiction, again, would draw on people from the past. It's always a real mixture of sources. But certainly I try to start with a very meaty, dramatic situation and then sort of deduce the character. Like in Room, for instance, you know, I knew that this mother was going to be able to get her kid out. And I thought, okay, what strengths would you need to make a childhood livable and in many ways fun and magical under those terrible circumstances of a locked door? Therefore, what qualities would Ma need to have?
So how do you get there? Is there a sort of ritual? You just sit down, you're there, you open it up, type?
I couldn't care less where I am. I've written my books occasionally sitting cross-legged on somebody's lawn while I wait for my kids to come out of summer camp. I've written on benches, in cafes, planes, trains, automobiles, quite a lot on my treadmill desk at home. But I'm not attached to any one place because really I'm not there. You know, that's just my body. My mind is in my laptop, as it were. So I really couldn't care less myself where I am.
So how do you get there? Is there a sort of ritual? You just sit down, you're there, you open it up, type?
I get my kids out of the house. I flip open the laptop. I'm there. I'm so happy to have the undisturbed time. That's the great thing about motherhood. It divides your life into the time that you're on call and the time you have to yourself. So it makes work into a real pleasure.
Okay. So besides becoming a mother, any other advice? Any other advice that you want to give to somebody who's just starting out as a writer? You know, maybe a mistake that you made or an encouragement that came from your own experience.
I used to think that publishers knew what would sell. When I wrote my fourth book, my first historical novel called Slammerkin, and my publishers at the time dumped me rapidly, no negotiation possible. I thought for a moment that they were right and that the book would never sell. And then it sold much better than my previous ones had. So I thought, aha, they have no idea. It's all guesswork. Just you write the book you want to write. And if you write it with enough passion and enough skill, maybe other people will want to read it too.
What's the sort of worst thing or worst piece of advice you ever got about writing?
Oh, yeah, I find the line, write what you know, extremely unhelpful. I mean, maybe it could squeeze a good, authentic first novel out of somebody based on their own life experience and whatever summer job they had at 14. But then they've used up their material, you know. I think, in fact, writing what you can dare to research and imagine is a far better line to live by.
Is there a book or a work that made you want to be a writer?
Yes, actually, Jeanette Winterson's novel, The Passion.
Oh, God, I'm so with you, except I have none of your talent for writing.
Well, I can't write like her, but the novel didn't make me want to write like her. It just made me really want to write.
There's so much I remember from that book. How about, is there a desert island book, you know, that you really want on your nightstand, or what's on your nightstand now?
For my desert island, I would bring Emily Dickinson's Complete Poems. You know, it's not off-puttingly dry or anything. They're very enjoyable, but you could also keep puzzling over what they mean for probably as long as your life on the desert island would last.
Well, Emma Donoghue, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure.
That was Virginia Prescott speaking with Emma Donoghue, author of Room, Frog Music, and most recently, The Wonder. You can listen to past episodes of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop anytime by subscribing to the podcast. You'll find it on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a rating. I know we sound like a broken record when we ask you this, but it really does help other people find it. And as you can imagine, we're all about word-of-mouth advertising. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Broke for Free, and David Seste. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. Don't forget that you can listen to the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes, Google Play, or really wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got a lot of driving ahead of you this holiday season, we have a suggestion. Make a playlist of your favorite podcasts. We at Word of Mouth have a vast archive of great shows for you to revisit or share with friends. Not only does it help pass the time, it will give you plenty of things to talk about around the dinner table. We guarantee it. I'm Logan Shannon, in for Virginia Prescott. Fear not, Virginia will be back on the mic this weekend for our very special gift show. We hope you'll stay tuned for that. It's airing at 12 o'clock noon on Sunday. Until then, this is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donoghue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.